every day on 4CA. John McKenzie, 1300 872 911.
Yeah, 17 past 10. I think this is a very interesting story. It's across page 13 of the Cairns Post today under the heading Tick, Tick, Boom. Rangers find dangerous unexploded ordnance in a state forest. Now, it says here, three 80-year-old bombs, that's right, 80-year-old bombs discovered by rangers in the Bilwan State Forest might have been rusted on the outside, but their insides remained as deadly as the day they were manufactured. Ranger Ben Finity from the Queensland Parks Wildlife Service said rangers were patrolling the state forest on the Tablelands and found three 25-pound unexploded ordnance. October 23. I won't go through all the details. One of the quotes reads here, last year we had a series of fire breaks constructed through the state forest to assist with the fire management, and the new fire breaks gave rangers better access. And during a routine patrol, they discovered several unexploded ordnance in a remote part of the forest. I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? In all these 80 years, they weren't found. And as soon as they started doing some fire breaks, etc., what does it do? It exposes those very dangerous bombs. Now, I won't go through all the details. Mr. Finity said it showed that even though the UXOs had been sitting on the ground for 80 years, they were still highly dangerous and ready to, can you believe this, ready to explode. Mr. Finity said the UXOs most likely relate back to the rich history Mareeba and the Tablelands had during World War II. I'm going to talk to an expert in these matters in just a moment, but for those of you who've just arrived in North Queensland recently and not aware of what was going on in World War II, the Japanese came very, very close to invading the northern part of Australia, and it was originally in their plans, obviously, thank God, with the assistance of the United States and, of course, incredible bravery from our own forces who were able to turn them back in the jungles of New Guinea. We avoided that the invasion, if you like. But there was a hell of a lot of activity. Now, the Atherton Tablelands, of course, was part of it. There were hospitals all over the place. The Red Lynch Valley, if I remember rightly, was also the site of a hospital. It wasn't just Australian soldiers getting treated, United States soldiers as well. So it was so busy as far as the frontier of the war was concerned up here. It's hard to imagine just how it was transformed so quickly. But what I'm going to do now is actually talk to a gentleman. I met him the other day at an Order of Australia function at the Council Chambers. And he was actually the comp here, but he was so interesting. I found out more about that gentleman, went and said good day, and found out that he's actually a guide up there on the Tablelands. He's a renowned World War II historian, as well as being a local tour guide. And I've got him actually waiting on the line. His name is John Hardy, OAM, Order of Australia Medal. John, good morning.
Good morning, John. Good to hear you on the radio.
John, good to be able to talk to you because not many people know the Tablelands better. You're also a World War II historian, which makes it even more important for me to catch up with you. When you found out about these bombs up there, what were your thoughts immediately? I mean, what's the level of danger? How would they have got there in the first place, etc.? What's your story?
Yeah, well, in 1943, we had an influx of 100,000 soldiers and nurses and all the auxiliary forces here to set up training camps for our soldiers that come back from the Middle East, the 6th, 7th and 9th divisions come back here, and they come out of desert warfare and they had to be trained in jungle warfare before they went up into New Guinea. So they come into the Ravensau area, the 7th division, 6th division come into Wandekla, and the 9th Division come into what's known as the Kirai area, but today is called Tinaru. So they occupy these areas, and with them, they have their artillery field regiments, and of course, they had to be trained, and we also had an ordnance depot here at Tolga, where I live, the largest ordnance depot in North Queensland. There was 18 of these igloos. If you can picture Maryland's Hall in Atherton, that was an army canteen. Well, we had 18 of those out here at Tolga, and they had everything from, you know, blankets and stretchers and all the bits and pieces a soldier needs to carry webbing, but they also had a storage area there for munitions. And, and of course, these ranges were set up, training ranges were set up, and certainly Bilwan would have been one of them where the ordnance was found there, unexploded ordnance. And, there's others, Ravensow area, up in Wandekla, and even west of Mareeba at Kaimalo. They're all training areas. And at, out past Urban Bank at Mont Albion, they're all impact areas for the artillery when they were being fired. John, I'll just let you have a word.
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, did they fail to explode, or were they just left behind when everyone packed up and left at the end of the war?
Yeah, well, they can be both. When you fire artillery rounds, everyone doesn't go bang. There's ones that go in and don't explode. And so there were people trained, even the present-day military are trained to go into these areas and clear what's called UXOs, unexploded ordnance. And, of course, you don't find them all. They can land in inaccessible areas that people can't always get to. And, of course, especially after heavy rainfall conditions, a lot of these can be unearthed, John, and in the case of putting fire trails through these areas, they must also uncover them as well.
You talk about those 18... Well, they're a strange-looking building. I think you've still got one up there. What are they called again? The big... round
the
roof.
The igloos.
The igloos. Yeah, there's still one. Is there only one left up there now, or what have you
well,
got?
Well, there's the one at the Atherton Showground, and that's about 60 metres by 40 metres long.
Yes.
And we had 18 of those out here at Tolga. But we also had the smaller ones, like opposite the Rocky Creek War Memorial Park. There were 6 entertainment igloos, and they're about 40 metres long by 20 metres wide. So, they were spread across the tableland as well, but they're just for entertainment and not for storage of military equipment.
Opposite Rocky Creek, they were working on restoring that. How did it go?
Yeah, it's going real well. But even today, the Atherton Rotary Club taking that on as a project to restore it. The back section, the stage area, needs to be still restored, waiting on grants for that. And, if you go online to, I believe it's Restoration World War II Igloo, you'll see a Facebook page and some nice photos there that shows the use of the premises today, particularly for weddings. They have some beautiful weddings down there. At night time, it comes up really impressive.
Yeah.
All the parabolic arches that holds the roof up, they come up good at night time with some nice lighting on them.
John, I presume when you're taking your customers across the Tablelands, you try and paint a picture of how the place would have looked back from 1943 to the end of the war. What do you say to them? I mean, we're talking about the population of a significantly sized city. 100,000 people turning up overnight. I mean, yes. It must have been absolute chaos. Can you paint a picture for us of what it would have looked like and how people would have experienced it?
Yeah, it's hard to visualise the transition.
Yes.
I think our population across the Tableland today is about 50, so you had double today's population up here that come in between, say, 19, at the end of 42 and 43. There was significant development of all these complexes, even at Rocky Creek, largest military hospital complex in the Southern Hemisphere that housed, you know, there's 5,000 soldiers and looked after by 2,000 caring soldiers and nurses there. So you can't believe it, no sites for sewers. I live at Tolga, just out of town, and I don't have sewage today, John, yet that precinct, it had sewage.
Incredible.
So it's a bit hard to believe and think of. Yes, soldiers come and soldiers went, because even on the line that went from Tolga out to Kirai, you know, the different divisional troops that got off at Kirai, just in front of the pub there, you know, there could be 13 to 20,000 troops get off each time a division come in or went out.
No.
Quite often by train.
Hell.
It's big business.
How the hell did they feed them all?
Yeah, well, that's another thing. I used to work for the Department of Primary Industries, and during World War II, the research facility there was taken over by the 5th Australian Farm Company, primarily to grow, fruit and produce for them to feed them, but no way in the world could you could feed the whole tableland off that small block. And, of course, a lot of this foodstuffs had to be brought in, fresh product had to be brought in to the tableland. And the significance of our railway lines can't be overemphasised. Today they just want to pull them up as quick as they can, but those days they were the lifeblood of our nation. And all the troops, like 30 to 40 trains a day would come up the Paranda range there, up to the tableland here. A bit hard to believe, isn't it?
It's almost impossible to get your head around. Can I just ask you, too, about the Air Force, too? I mean, the bombers coming and going, and I presume smaller planes as well. How frequently, and were there mishaps there? I presume some of them struggled to get back to the tablelands?
Yeah, well, they are all recorded. We've got an FNQ Aviation Museum on the western end of the east-west airstrip, which had to be constructed... It started on the 12th of May 1942, and they built that airstrip in something like just under about 9 days they built that.
Yes.
So you think about it, just to build an airstrip, the east-west one, whereas the north-south one was already there. Just moving on from that, it's initially occupied by the number 100 Squadron, and then the United States Army Air Force come in during 43-44, there's recordings of 10,000 American service people coming in to support what was at that airport. But across the rest of the tableland, it was primarily our 6th, 7th and 9th Division of the 2nd Australian Imperial Force.
God, this is fascinating. Bloody fascinating. What's the response from people when you take them around? I mean, I presume a lot of them can't get their head around it.
They can't get their head around it. And even towards the end of the trip, we finish at the Atherton War Cemeteries. And so I can tell stories there, you know, my offsider, Nicole Smith, who comes around with me, we go through and we identify graves of significance. And one of them I'll just relate to artillery, in that these ordnance rounds had just been found. There was a mess parade one day, soldiers of the headquarters of the 2nd 16th Australian Infantry Battalion were lined up waiting for their lunch, and the 2nd 5th Field Regiment were firing over their head. And what happens is what's called a drop shot, and that round fell in amongst them, and there's six of those soldiers eventually died from that impact, and they're buried in the war cemetery. It's sobering in that these fellas have been up on Kokoda defending the Japanese and come back here for a training before they went back up there again with the 7th Division, and, you know, to be killed on your home soil here in a training accident.
Yes.
And, you know, six of them, their graves are still there today to give recognition to, John.
Not everything went smoothly, apparently, according to the late Tommy Franks, when some of the Australian forces met up with some of the American forces who they suspected were dating the girls they wanted to make their girlfriends. And there was a hell of a blue where the Pacific Hotel... Pacific Hotel is today, just outside, well, it was probably basically a hotel then too, just outside of that. It was an all-in brawl, according to Tommy Franks.
Yeah, there's some great stories. sometimes a bit of blood and lust involved, but they're all good tales. But the Yanks, they had plenty of money and they had plenty of stockings in their pockets to enhance our lovely ladies. And, our soldiers used to take offence to that because, all's fair in love and war. And they'll fisticuffs with a couple of... the old tallies under them from Cairns Draft there, Brewery, and they were into it.
John, when you come down, you've probably been down there, at Trinity Beach, they've done a wonderful memorial with photographic... Oh, you've seen it. Isn't that magnificent with those, with the landing craft and the training for those who were going to be needing to be able to handle those landing craft, which had to follow, of course, when Australia really launched out of Australia into the jungles of New Guinea. My God, those battles up there, just amazing. But the Australian forces did remarkably well against the Japanese, which at Milne Bay virtually turned the tide of the war.
They did, and you've got to remember they were militia units there, the 61st Battalion Queensland Cameron Highlanders, the 9th Battalion, the Morton Regiment, and the 25th Battalion, the Darling Down Regiment. They inflicted the first land defeat of the Japanese Imperial Forces at Milne Bay.
Yeah. Just remarkable. Don't go away. How do you do these tours? How frequently and how do people get involved in them?
I could drop out, but if I drop out, we'll come back. But, I do them in the winter months of the year when the grey nomads are on the tableland.
Yep.
June, July, August. We operate the bookings out of the Information Centre at Atherton.
Okay.
Information Centre.
Excellent. Yep. John, this has been fascinating. We'll stay in touch when some of these matters come up from time to time, because you're the expert and you tell very, very interesting stories. Wonderful accounts. Thank you.
Yeah, we've got quite a few military historians here, so we should probably give them all recognition, John.
Okay. Now, we thought he warned us just in time he was about to drop out. That's John Hardy, OAM. He's the World War II historian and local tour guide.